Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for July's Nurses Club webinar. I'm delighted to introduce you to our speaker for today, veterinary technician specialist in emergency critical care and small animal internal medicine, Kenichiro Yagi. Thank you, Kenichiro. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you. Okay. So I'd like to start out this presentation by asking you to do a breathing exercise. So I hope everyone's well rested. The first rule to this exercise is don't pass out. And what I mean by that is that I'm going to be asking you to do a few things. And while you do so, if you feel lightheaded, anything like that, just go ahead and stop what I'm asking you to do because I've already made my point. Okay, step one, just go ahead and take a couple of deep breaths. Hope that's enough time. And how did that feel? Most people would say something like, it's relaxing. I felt good. That, when people take deep breaths, it's typically because they're a little bit nervous. Maybe they're anxious for some kind of reason. Deep breaths are sort of called things like calming breaths, relaxing breaths, cleansing breaths. And I kind of think of it as us being able to take a deep breath. It's all that oxygen getting into your blood, taking it to the brain, and the brain feels good. Being able to breathe is a good thing. The second step, and don't do it yet, is to take 1/5 of the normal volume that you breathe in, not even that deep breath that we just talked about, but a normal breath that you're doing as you're sitting there, restricting it to about 20%, a very small amount. You're going to do it 10 times in a row and on my count. Okay, ready? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 10. Okay, how did that feel? Most of the time, what people say when I ask that question is that it felt bad, right? It didn't feel good at all. That the deep breaths felt good. This time, it didn't feel so good. Some people might have come with a sense of panic, an urge to breathe. Their heart rate might have gone up. Their heart might have felt like it was pounding much harder than normal, it doesn't feel good. We're supposed to be able to breathe a lot better than that. And step three is to now imagine that's how you feel all the time, hours on end. And take a look at this next video.
It's not as good as it was.
In here, right?
Yeah, and she came in muddy and not doing good things.
As we watch this patient, you could probably see a lot of characteristic things about patients that come in with respiratory distress that we'll talk about a little bit further down the line. When we think about triage, there's a set of letters that we could go by. A, B, C, D is what I go by. Airway, breathing, circulation, dysfunction, and external signs. And that airway and breathing is always in the beginning. And that's because breathing is so important. But why is it so important is something that we should get into first. And in order to do that, we're going to talk a little bit about normal breathing first. This person has no issues breathing. It's an allergy ad or something like that, but she's living up. When we think about that normal breathing, does it require work? As you're sitting there, does it seem like you're working hard to breathe at all? And for the most of you guys, the answer is probably no. you're not even thinking about it. It's automatic. It's not something that is painful or anything like that. There is some work involved, though, in that there are muscles that will increase the chest cavity size in order for an animal to breathe. There is a longitudinal change in the chest cavity size with the diaphragm contracting. And this is a human diagram that, shows the diaphragm moving downward as it contracts and then upward as it relaxes. If you think about an animal, as the diaphragm relaxes, it comes back cranially towards the head. And then as it contracts, it elongates the chest cavity caudally away from the head. There's also a circumferential change of the chest cavity size through the use of the intercostal muscles and, to a certain degree, use of the abdominal muscles so that the chest cavity can actually widen. By creating that change in the volume of the chest cavity, but no change in the gas, it creates a negative pressure area within the chest cavity, which leads to a pressure gradient, zero on the outside, or atmospheric pressure on the outside, negative pressure on the inside, which leads the air to rush in from the positive side to the negative side, the higher side to the lower side. And what my physics teacher in high school used to say was that there's nothing that really sucks in physics except for your grades. And that was definitely true for me. But what he meant to say was that by creating that negative pressure, moving those muscles, and creating the pressure gradient, you're making things move into the area of low pressure. You're not really sucking anything in. So sucking is a misnomer in physics. This pressure gradient that is being created by the muscle movement, that muscle movement is what constitutes the work of breathing. And that work of breathing gets larger and larger as the animal's ability to breathe diminishes. When you take a look at the lungs itself, and say you were to pour in plasticizing material into the lungs, this is what you would see. You could probably imagine, as the air comes in to the trachea, branches to the bronchi, keeps on branching, and you see these little terminal branches that you could almost imagine grape-like bunches of alveoli hanging off of. All of this stuff that you can visualize on this photo is what's considered the conducting airspace, where the air is moved towards the alveoli that create the blood-gas barrier. And by volume, 5% of the lung's volume is comprised of this conducting airway. 95% of the volume is comprised of the respiratory zone, which we'll talk about in a second as well. That's all around this white stuff. And so what you're seeing here is considered the anatomic dead space, parts of the lungs that don't participate in gas exchange. So the airway is divided up into two different areas, the conducting zone that is made up of the trachea, bronchi, terminal bronchioles as it branches smaller and smaller, further and further. Again, consider the anatomic dead space that doesn't participate in gas exchange. And then we start to enter the respiratory zone, going into the respiratory bronchioles. You can start to see these alveoli budding off of the side of the walls, and then terminating in the alveolar ducts and the sacs. There's an exponential increase in surface area by this point, which allows for that gas exchange to occur. And that increase in surface area is very important because in order for gases to get into the bloodstream, we need that exponential increase to occur. Now, it's not only enough for air to get down to that exponential surface area of lung tissue. We also need it to meet blood flow. And so the blood also branches in the same way. It comes off of the heart, goes into the pulmonary artery, into the lung tissues, branches, and turns into the capillaries, and then converges back to the pulmonary vein and back to the heart, pump to the rest of the body. At the point of this capillary bed that's around the lungs, the diameter of the capillaries are about 7 to 10 micrometers, which is just about the right diameter for red blood cells to be going through in a single file line. And it really looks like this meshwork of capillaries. It's often called a sheet of blood because it's so meshed together that it just looks like a sheet. And you can imagine that there is an increase, exponential increase in surface area of the blood vessels as well that meets the exponential surface area increase of the lung tissue. And that together creates the blood gas barrier. If we put it into a 3D structure, this is what it looks like. As the airway branches and comes down, there's all these alveoli that are lined by the sheet of blood. If we take one of these alveoli out and take a cross section, you can blow it up over here. This is what it looks like. The lung tissue having a single cell layer thickness, alveolus, that is wrapped around by the sheet of blood that we just talked about. And then right in between those two layers is what you would consider the blood gas barrier, where the air comes into the alveolus, diffuses through into the bloodstream, and gets taken away. A more simplified diagram looks like this. Deoxygenated and carbon dioxide rich blood comes to the alveolus, carbon dioxide comes out, air moves in and out, and more oxygen comes into the blood vessels, gets taken up by the red blood cells, and carried away to the rest of the body. So in terms of respiratory physiology, there's three different major concepts here. Ventilation, the ability for the air to move in and out. Oxygenation, ability for oxygen to move in, and to many degrees, carbon dioxide coming back out. And the perfusion, the bloodstream, the blood flow that goes to the lung tissues. And if all three of these components are not working properly, that's when you have respiratory dysfunction. And that function of the respiratory system is to be able to take in oxygen and deliver it to the rest of the cells, and removing CO2. And that's the primary function. There are some secondary functions like heat dissipation. It's also a part of the immune system, that sort of stuff. But it's mainly concerned with taking oxygen in and removing CO2 from the system. So the first question regarding that I have for you guys is, why do we even need oxygen? Why is that important? And if we think back to our high school biology class, you'll probably remember something called ATP, which is a form of energy. And it requires oxygen to make. Thinking about the mitochondria, the citric acid cycle, and the electron transport chain going through oxidative phosphorylation, all that sort of stuff. We can take glucose, mix it with oxygen and water to create much more ATP than if we would be able to without that process. And this process requires oxygen. So it's for aerobic respiration. Lack of oxygen leads to inability to produce enough ATP, which leads to shock. And that's the fundamental definition of shock: inability to produce enough energy to sustain life functions. So this ATP is very important. It's a form of cellular energy that is used in virtually everything that happens in our body. So, you know, needing oxygen is probably something that we all know about. Why do we need to remove CO2? What's the reason for that? If you said it because it affects the pH, that's exactly why it is. If you go back to your chemistry class, you might be able to remember one of these equations. It's an equilibrium equation of the forms that carbon takes, or carbon dioxide when it mixes with water, what it takes in the body. And so when you have CO2 building up in the body and mixes with water, which is what plasma is mostly made out of, in the bloodstream, then it can take on three different forms. It can be dissolved as carbon dioxide gas. It can form into carbonic acid, which can also dissociate into bicarb and protons. And they keep themselves, relatively speaking, from each other in the same amount of concentration depending on how much carbon is in the bloodstream. So what happens is, if as we build up CO2 on this side, which means that there's a lot more gas building up, this equation will shift to the right, which increases each of the components as the dissolved CO2 gas diminishes. So I hope you saw with that animation that when CO2 level goes up in the blood, it leads to an increase in protons. And that's what's considered acidosis, and it causes a reduction in the pH. But the opposite is true. If you start taking CO2 out of the bloodstream, then the equation shifts to the left, leading to a reduction in protons, causing alkalosis, or an increase in pH. And this is what's considered respiratory acidosis and alkalosis, because the respiratory system has the ability to remove CO2, or if it's dysfunctional, the inability to remove it. And so it's not just that important for the body to eliminate CO2, that it's the ability for the body to control the level of CO2 through the respiratory system that is really important. We just want to keep it in the right range. And why do we keep it in the right range? That's because a normal pH is important to many different kinds of systems. And there's a lot of information on this slide. I'm sure you're able to get back to it. There's the cardiovascular system, the nervous system, respiratory system, and metabolic functions that all get out of whack. As long if the pH goes away from the normal range, and the body does everything that it can to keep it in that range. This CO2 control is controlled by something called minute ventilation. And the body controls that. The minute ventilation is just the amount of air moving in and out of the lungs over a certain course of time, which is the tidal volume, VT there, times the respiratory rate. How big of a breath you take, and how often you take it within the minute. And the minute is just a convention. But what's really important is something called alveolar ventilation, which is the amount of air that moves in and out of this area. Because we said that there's no gas exchange that takes place as it comes down through the conducting zone. And there is this anatomic dead space that we talked about. So the equation to that is a little bit more modified. Tidal volume minus the dead space, that right there, times the respiratory rate. But fortunately, the dead space doesn't really change in size from moment to moment, breath to breath, in a particular patient, whether they're healthy or whether they're diseased. There are certain things that can change the dead space, which are things like if you were to endotracheally intubate the patient, then that changes the diameter of the trachea, reducing the dead space, but it adds mechanical dead space. When animal breathes with negative pressure ventilation, which is our spontaneous breathing, it pulls the airways open, so it increases the dead space a little bit. Positive pressure ventilation. Sorry, let me step back one second. Negative pressure ventilation will pull the airways in, reducing the dead space. Positive pressure ventilation, if you were to give a sigh to an animal, will push the airway open, increasing the dead space. But with that said, there are some details, but from breath to breath, moment to moment, in a particular animal, the dead space doesn't really change. And so you can think of this equation as the same as tidal volume times the respiratory rate for the most part. And so tidal volume and respiratory rate is the key component to CO2 control. And when an animal isn't able to sustain that very well, that's when you have respiratory issues regarding CO2. All right, to talk a little bit about the ventilation terms, just imagine when I say that animal is hyperventilating. What do you think? That person is hyperventilating. What does that look like? I think that the most of you would think, okay, rapid, shallow breaths. And that's what a person that is hyperventilating looks like. You probably think about something like this. I'm going to tell you that rapid, shallow breaths, or at least rapid breath, is just tachypnea. It's not necessarily hyperventilation. Hyperventilation is a situation where the person or the animal is breathing more than necessary, such that they are blowing off more CO2, leading to hypocarbia, which leads to respiratory alkalosis. It's different from tachypnea because if they are tachypneic, if they are having to increase their respiratory rate because they need to blow off more CO2 to keep up and keep the pH in the normal range, that's just tachypnea. They're just keeping up and they're not hyperventilating. So it's really dependent on the CO2 status of the animal. Hypoventilation is probably something that we run into more often as a problem with our patients. is when the patient doesn't have enough functional lung space or doesn't have the ability to breathe well enough with their respiratory muscles, such that CO2 being blown off isn't enough. It causes an increase in the CO2 level, leading to respiratory acidosis. And how do we know what level is the patient has? Well, we would do something called arterial blood gas. This is a situation where we can take a syringe that looks like this. It's a self-venting syringe. Pull up to the volume that you want to collect the blood up to. Poke it into an artery, and the blood pressure actually pushes the blood in as the syringe vents out the air that's in there. Take that blood sample, run it with a blood gas analyzer of some kind that you might have in your practice. And then it gives us certain numbers. And one of the numbers that it gives us is called PaO2, or the partial pressure within the artery exerted by the oxygen molecules. That measures our oxygenation level. And when I started studying these kinds of things, I first thought, well, why is it pressure? Why do we care about pressure? And aren't we looking for a concentration or amount of oxygen that's in the blood? That's explained by this concept, where there are certain kinds of molecules, or if you're taking a look at oxygen molecules within a certain container, that gas is moving around. There's actually a physical element to it. It's running into walls, running into other molecules, running into each other, and it creates a pressure. There's collision going on. If there is an increased concentration of that same molecule within the same volume container, then you can imagine that there's a lot more collisions that go on as the molecules are trying to move around, creating more pressure, and so it leads to a higher pressure measurement. I don't know if you guys have been to Japan, but in the subways during rush hour, there are actually people assigned to pushing more people into the cars so that they can get carried away and there's more efficient transport of people through the subway. Now, this is a situation where you take a finite container like a train, you push more and more things into it, more and more people into it, that creates more pressure, and that's kind of the same concept. A normal value of PaO2 is 80 to 110 millimeters of mercury. It's considered hypoxemia, below what's normal if it's less than 80 millimeters of mercury, and it's severe if it's less than 60 millimeters of mercury. Carbon dioxide has similar measurements as well. For dogs, CO2 level is 32 to 43 millimeters of mercury. Cats, 26 to 36 millimeters of mercury as a normal value. It's considered hypercapnia, or too much CO2 if it's greater than 45, severe if it's greater than 60. And so this is what makes up the 60s rule, that if the O2 is lower than 60, or CO2 is higher than 60, we're at a point where we have severe hypoxemia or severe hypercapnia, and that's a problem for an animal. Yeah, it's about that pressure. Poor people. Probably thinking, well, we don't do a lot of blood gas measurements. We don't do a lot of arterial blood sampling, and that's pretty typical for most veterinary practices. But you probably do have something called a pulse oximeter, which measures the amount of oxygen through pulse oximetry, or getting a measurement of SpO2 through infrared light. It has to do with hemoglobin saturation with oxygen, so how much of the hemoglobin is bound to oxygen itself. And a measurement of 95% is about equivalent to 80 millimeters of mercury. 90% is about equal to that severe hypoxemia level, or 60 millimeters of mercury. So once it starts getting below 90%, then you should really be worried about the patient's oxygenation. And so what about cyanosis? What do you guys think is the percentage of saturation by the time the animal is cyanotic? And there's a little bit of math involved with this, which I can go over if anyone is interested. But basically, it turns out to be about 70% or 66%. And it depends on the animal's PCV level or hematocrit level, how much hemoglobin is actually contained in the blood as a concentration. And sometimes they don't even turn blue if they're anemic. But with that said, by the time you see cyanosis, it's a very bad situation because you are way below what we consider severe hypoxemia. And so just because an animal is pink looking doesn't mean they are breathing adequately, and we should be aware of that. Carbon dioxide can also be measured with different mechanisms aside from arterial blood gas sampling. And the easiest one probably is to take a venous sample. Venous samples give you the measurement of the PV within the venous system, CO2, which is about 5 millimeters of mercury higher than what you would consider with the arteries, which makes sense because the blood has gone to the tissues, picked up more CO2, and so there should be a higher concentration of CO2 in the venous system than the arterial system. There is also end-tidal CO2 measurements that you can take, which is a form of taking a continuous measurement of CO2 breath by breath, but it does require establishment of an airway through the endotracheal tube. There are some fancy tubes that you could feed down into the oropharynx that might be able to measure it as well in an awake animal, but that's a little bit harder to come by. And it does correlate well with the arterial CO2 level, or PaCO2, though it drops with perfusion issues and severe respiratory issues. There's also something that's new that's out there called transcutaneous CO2 measurement, or blood gas measurements, actually, that you can shave off a patch of fur on an animal, place a adhesive sensor onto it, and after a little while, it will equilibrate with the amount of blood gas within the bloodstream. It is something that is extremely expensive at the moment. I've heard of many university practices or some private practices having the capability to do this. But with that said, it's not very widespread. There's some validation issues with the veterinary side at the moment that we're not able to recommend this at very strongly yet. But maybe something in the future. Okay, so that's normal breathing. Now let's talk about abnormal breathing. Hopefully this isn't something that happens in your home all the time. And when trying to detect an animal having abnormal breathing, the first thing that we do is a visual assessment of the patient, or actually what I should say is as we're even walking up to an animal that has been brought in for breathing issues or for an issue, we should be able to tell how they're breathing. And we can take a look at their face. You may have an animal that looks like this. What do you notice? Probably see that we have an anxious look. The eyes aren't focused on anything in particular. The patient is open mouth breathing. Sometimes, and I'm not saying this is necessarily the case with this particular patient, but when an animal is breathing more fiercely, as they're breathing out, breathing in, the flaps of the nose could be sucked in and pushed out, and so there's flarings of nostrils that occur. And again, when you see cyanosis, which this patient really looks like, that's a late sign of hypoxemia and respiratory issues. There's also something called mentation that we're looking for, how alert the animal actually is. And there's different degrees of it that we would can describe it in, alert, obtunded, stuporous, and comatose. And as the patient's ability to deliver oxygen to the brain gets worse and worse, the patient goes from being alert to less and less responsive. And so here is an example of an animal that has a little bit more of a focus issue that the mentation is starting to become a little bit worse. And I hope you were able to see with that particular patient that there were a couple of points. Towards the beginning of the video, there was some clicking noise going on, and the ears were twitching, and even though she was looking downward and closing her eye a little bit before that point, when that sound came up, she looked up and looked towards the direction that where she thought the sound might have come from. And then later in the video, she followed somebody's movement as the person was walking by, but once that person went away, she went back to being a little more depressed, eyes closing, head being drooped down, and just focusing on the breathing. So that's a situation where the patient is obtunded or requires some kind of stimulus, external stimulus, to regain alertness. Now let's take a look at this patient and see how this patient's alertness is. You could probably tell that this patient is a lot less focused on anything that's going on around. The eyes are glazed over. There's a significant amount of breathing effort for sure. It's not like we would go into the cage and jostle the patient to see if he would respond or regain alertness or anything like that. But he's somewhere between that stuporous and comatose level where the oxygen delivery to his brain is being so compromised that his alertness has significantly been diminished. And this is a patient that had congestive heart failure and severe pulmonary edema because of it, which led to the brain hypoxia and dysfunction. So you can see that as the level of oxygen being delivered to the brain gets less and less, lower and lower, the impairment of mentation is going to be more significant. Okay, so let's talk about abdominal effort. So that was the external visual signs that you could see. In terms of abdominal effort, abdominal effort is added on to the breathing effort when the patient wants to increase the chest even further than what it can with its chest muscles. And so it's an effort for the animal to try to maximize tidal volume. And as it gets, as the breathing effort gets heavier and heavier, more the abdominal effort is being added on, you'll see something called paradoxical breathing. And that's when the patient is breathing out significantly. There's air trying to flow in from the outside through the trachea into the lungs, but the airflow doesn't keep up with the pressure that the patient is creating within the chest, and so the pressure transfers to the abdomen, so the abdomen sucks in. So the chest goes out, abdomen sucks in. Same thing happens when the patient's trying to breathe out. The chest goes in, the pressure gets transferred to the abdomen, so the abdomen goes out. And so there's a paradoxical movement of the abdomen and the chest, so opposing movement. And this is a chinchilla that has paradoxical breathing. So you could probably already appreciate that the chest and the abdomen are moving in an asynchronous manner. And look right about now that it gets more pronounced. And so this just means that the patient is having enough difficulty breathing that the airflow isn't keeping up with the patient's need. And so they're in trouble. There are other breathing patterns that could arise. One of them is called obstructive breathing pattern, where the inspiration or expiration is prolonged, a lot longer than what you think it should be. And it has to do with a narrowed airway. Just imagine if you had to breathe through a straw and take a full breath. It should take you a lot longer to reach that full breath than if you had your normal airway without that straw. This here is a patient that has a narrowed upper airway. So you could probably tell that this patient has something stuck in his nose. Basically, it's nasal discharge. Now, this is a patient that had severe nasal discharge, narrowed upper airway. It's not like he was having enough breathing issues that that was going to be concern for his life necessarily. But with that said, when he has his mouth closed, he's trying to breathe through his nose that's been narrowed. It takes a lot longer for him to take the full breath and then even to breathe out. And so that's the same type of thing that you're thinking about, that you'll be looking for. There's also something called restrictive breathing pattern, where the breath is more shallow, it's tachypneic, there's a lot, the animal is breathing a lot faster, but they're not expanding their lungs as much as they normally would be. And these are situations where the patient has to compensate for the loss of lung volume through pleural space diseases, like pleural effusion, could be a hemothorax. There's space, there, the pleural space is space around the lungs. If the space is filled by something, air, fluid, infection, then the lungs are not able to expand as large. It could be due to compliance issues where the lung tissues are stiffened or the chest is being impeded by something else physically to be expanded. Then the patient has to compensate by breathing faster. So pneumothorax, pleural effusion, pulmonary fibrosis, these are the situations that we're talking about. Okay, so let's take a look at this next video and take a look at this patient and think about whether you think the patient has a respiratory issue or not. So this patient definitely had abdominal effort and breathing, and so there's a lot more effort going into the breathing. And I'm going to tell you that this patient actually didn't have a respiratory issue. This is an example of a non-respiratory look-like, or what it's called. And it's a result of compensatory ventilation. This particular patient has severe severe metabolic acidosis, and the body was trying to blow off more CO2 to create a respiratory alkalosis effect to compensate for the metabolic acidosis, to try to balance it out. And so when the patient has things like severe anemia, metabolic acidosis, even hyperthermia, the patient would be breathing excessively in order to compensate for something that's going on. Anemia would be hypoxemia. Metabolic acidosis would be to try to remove more CO2 for adjustment of the pH. Hyperthermia would be to try to blow off more heat through evaporation. Could be due to neurologic disease where the breathing pattern is not normal due to the respiratory center not functioning properly. Anesthesia and drugs can change respiratory patterns, pain and anxiety as well. So just so you know that not all respiratory patterns are due to respiratory disease. Okay, so that was a respiratory pattern. Let's think about the posture. In one of the videos that we just watched, the cat that was in the cage was sitting up like this. This is called orthopnea, where the patient is sternal. They position themselves so that their shoulders are opened up, elbows are not touching the chest cavity, chest walls, I should say. And their necks are often stretched out to try to reduce the amount of resistance that the animal has to breathe against in order to get air into the lungs. Here's another example of a severe situation where the patient is exhibiting orthopnea. And so this is probably something that we instinctively know as animals that are having difficulty breathing, and there's a physical reason to that. What if they are recumbent? Is that any better? Let's take a look at this video of a recumbent patient to take a look at the rate and the pattern, pay attention to that, and we'll discuss it a little bit afterwards. I'm not sure if you guys noticed that change in the breathing. It'll happen another time. Okay, so how would you describe the patient's breathing? If you had said things like there's significant effort, there's paradoxical breathing, and a variable rate, then you've captured most of what I wanted to talk about. And we want to focus a lot on this variable rate. If you had noticed in the video, there were a couple of points where the patient was breathing rapidly. Rapidly, and then having this exhaustive expansion of the chest, and then starting to breathe a little bit slowly, and then sped back up again, and then started breathing a little bit slowly. And this variable rate, if you think about the amount of energy that it takes for the patient to try to breathe through respiratory dysfunction, and the amount of energy that the body's being able to create through the respiration that it's physically able to create. You could probably see that as the respiratory function becomes more and more dysfunctional, the level of energy being created becomes lower and lower. And what's meeting it is the increased energy that's required to breathe harder and harder. And at a certain point, the amount of energy being created is not going to be enough to sustain the amount of energy required to breathe, which leads to a situation where the patient doesn't have enough energy to continue breathing with the significant effort that it's required. And that's where you start to see the patient breathing fast, running out of energy, and then breathing slow, recuperating for a little while, and then with the energy being recuperated a little bit more, being able to breathe a little bit faster to bring it back up, and then doing that over and over. And there are other things that could change the respiratory rate, but in a respiratory dysfunction case, when you see something like that, you would be thinking about impending respiratory fatigue and possible respiratory arrest leading to death of the patient. And so it's something that really is a is something that you don't want to see in your patient. That was all visible, visual effects that you could see from the patient of respiratory distress. Let's think about auditory. I'm sure we've all seen animals like that, and those are pretty typical breeds that it comes in. That's a breathing sound called stridor, first of all. It's a sort of a grating noise, a harsh noise that you can hear with changes in flows of air through the upper airway, larynx, trachea, bronchi. And in that particular situation, it was laryngeal paralysis. These muscles that normally work, the cricoarytenoideus muscles, that normally work to pull the airway open. When it becomes dysfunctional, there's nerve damage, whatever it might be, that leads to atrophy of that the muscle. It narrows the airway that was much more open to something that is much more smaller, and so they're having to breathe through a narrowed airway, creating that grating noise, a stridor. What's wrong with this pug? And you're probably saying it's a pug. Of course, there's so many things wrong with it, and I'm referring specifically to the airway. that there is something called brachycephalic syndrome that these smushed-faced guys have that narrows or obstructs the airway. And one of them is a stenotic nares, where you can see from the left and the right that the airway actually should be a lot wider open if you had a normal nose. They can also have something called elongated soft palates that overlap with the opening of the airway in the oropharynx. And a hypoplastic trachea, which are, for these particular breeds, the brachycephalic breeds, the trachea actually doesn't develop as well proportionally as an animal that is dolichocephalic. And this is just congenital, so they're breathing through an internal straw. Through the negative pressure that's being created by the respiratory effort, there's soft tissues around the airway that loosens up and sometimes everts itself, like the laryngeal saccules, closing up the airway even further. The treatment for this, say an animal like this is out outside on a hot day, goes to the park, and comes in with respiratory distress because they've exerted themselves, there's inflammation going on in the airway, is to be able to intubate them, endotracheally intubate them, secure that airway, allow them to breathe, and then that might require general anesthesia and heavy sedation afterwards until that inflammation goes down. Once that inflammation goes down, then there are surgical options. Laryngeal paralysis would be a laryngeal tieback. Stenotic nares could be trimmed away. Elongated soft palates could be trimmed away as well. There's a laser that people use to do these surgeries these days, which is pretty cool. But it's to remove the physical obstruction of the airway. These upper airway obstructions are bad because narrowing or obstruction of the airway would cause an increase in airway resistance, which leads to either the animal having to take small frequent breaths, tachypnea, to keep up with the amount of to create enough breaths to create enough ventilation with the increased resistance, which leads to a reduction in tidal volume, or large infrequent breaths taking a longer time to get the full breath, reducing the respiratory rate. And either way, that alveolar ventilation that we talked about gets reduced because the tidal volume or the respiratory rate will go down significantly, reducing the alveolar ventilation. And once this alveolar ventilation gets to the point that it's too low to sustain good function, that's when you lead to the animal experiences hypercapnia, increase in CO2, or hypoxemia, reduction in O2. We had a Rottweiler patient that came in with respiratory distress, stumbled into the ER. We could hear a whistling noise. He was out in the park playing, and as we were trying to examine him, he panicked, and then he passed out, collapsed and passed out. So because he was collapsed out, our veterinarian could actually take a look into the mouth and said, "Oh my God, get me like, you know, something that I can grab this out with." So we gave her a towel forceps, and she pulled this out. Now, I don't know if you guys know these balls, but they're called pimple balls. There is this hole that you can see over here, and there's another hole on the other end of this, creating a narrow passage that the air could flow through, and this ball had lodged in the throat of this Rottweiler that we saw. And the positioning was really fortunate because the holes were aligned just right to the trachea so that the patient could breathe in and out through it. And otherwise, if it wasn't the case, then he may not have made it to the emergency room. I heard that this pimple ball was something that was recalled, and so I looked it up on Google. There's a lot of good stuff on there. Snopes, pimple ball, dog toy warning, pimple ball recall, four paws products, toy safety warnings. There's also something here that says how to instantly get rid of pimples. So if you guys need that, that's there too. Google is a great place. But what I found out was that it was actually not due to any kind of respiratory situation, but it was an animal that had chewed the hole open, got its tongue stuck, the tongue became necrotic, and so it had to be amputated. So they recalled it to redo the design or something like that. But with that said, as I go around talking to people about this particular case, I've run into many people who have experienced the same. So the pimple balls are not good for large dogs. If we couldn't get the obstruction removed, then what we would have had to do was an emergency tracheostomy where the neck is opened up, we make a horizontal incision into the trachea, horizontal because there's cartilaginous rings that we can't cut through in a vertical manner, and insert this tube, the tracheostomy tube, to bypass the obstruction, allowing the patient to breathe in and out through this tube. But fortunately, we didn't have to do that. Okay, so what else can we hear? Well, I hope everyone's heard crackles before. And crackles are something that we can hear from atelectic alveoli popping open, popping closed, popping open, popping closed, and that all happening in a staggered manner all around the lungs. And it's due to fluid accumulation. Fluid accumulation reduces the surface tension, or sorry, increases surface tension because there's surfactants that normally allow the lungs to open up a lot easier. And that's diminished when there are fluid accumulation or pathology that reduces surfactant secretion. And the location is telling, where if it was something like aspiration pneumonia, we'd hear it first on the cranial ventral right side lung lobe, because if you think about how the airway branches, it's that lung lobe that branches off of the trachea first. And so with aspiration pneumonia, food matter that's dripping through with gravity, it would be introduced to the cranioventral right lung lobe first. If it was something like cardiogenic pulmonary edema, then it starts at the base of the heart because it has to do with pressure buildup, hydrostatic pressure buildup at the base of the heart where the congestion is occurring. This cardiogenic pulmonary edema can be explained through this diagram that normally the right side, this is the right side, of the heart pushes lungs, blood to the lungs, gets oxygenated, comes back to the heart, pumps to the rest of the body, gets deoxygenated because it's delivering oxygen, comes back and does that cycle over and over. If there is left-sided lung failure and congestion, you can see that the pressure would start building up towards the lungs. And as the pressure builds, the vessels stretch out, there's an increase in hydrostatic pressure, there's an increase in leaking of water into the tissues in the surrounding area, into the lungs, which leads to pulmonary hypertension, fluid effusion, and the pulmonary edema. It can happen with fluid overload as well, especially if the patient has subclinical heart disease that we didn't know about and we put them on high volume fluid rate, or even with patients that has normal heart functions could experience pulmonary edema if we provide them with too high of volume infusions. That's why in surgery, when we do a high fluid rate, we tend to be a little bit more cautious about that. Here's an x-ray of an animal that has pulmonary edema, cardiogenic pulmonary edema. You can see the white patchiness of this lungs. And the heart is enlarged, which is a pretty good sign of heart disease. And the treatment for that would be to use something called diuretics that pulls the fluid out of the body, hopefully removing plasma volume, which reduces the pressure, antihypertensives, which dilates the blood vessels, which reduces the blood pressure as well, and then using some kind of heart medication when appropriate to provide inotropic effects, which is creating the ability for more contractility to the heart, pushing the blood forward, and so reducing the congestion. So the strategy is towards reducing plasma volume, reducing systemic vascular resistance, which is the vasodilation effect, and increasing forward flow to remove congestion. There's also something called non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema, though, that has to do with increased permeability due to inflammation and inflammatory mediators causing more permeable blood vessels and more leakage going on. There are various causes, and they all have to do with things that, as you can imagine, that causes inflammation of the vessels. And the treatment is to treat the underlying cause and provide respiratory support through that. Here's an example of an x-ray that still has that white patchiness, as you can see, but a normal-sized heart. Pulmonary edema is bad because it causes something called shunting, an area with perfusion without ventilation. If you can imagine this alveolus that has the blood gas barrier being filled with fluid, the gas is unable to get to the blood gas barrier. Not sure if you know what the water trap under your sink and the toilet is for, but it is to prevent gas from getting in. This side is the sewage. This is your sink, for example. And gas will continuously or consistently try to get into your house, but meet this water trap, which is not able to dissolve through to a significant degree, and then come into your house floor. Without this water trap, what would happen is that the gas would freely come into your home, and you have a very stinky home. So, a good invention. For the lungs, this water is not a good thing, because it prevents water or prevents air from getting to the blood gas barrier that we want it to. And so then it passes by deoxygenated and full of carbon dioxide. There's something called ventilation perfusion mismatch or VQ mismatch. And there's no gas exchange that occurs through that blood gas barrier. Okay, what if there's no sound? That means that there's a lack of air movement due to pleural effusion. Here's an example of an x-ray that has of a patient that has pleural effusion. You can see an outline of the lungs floating in this radiopaque area that has a bunch of fluid accumulated. Tends to be, when the patient has caudal pleural effusion, it tends to be on the caudal to ventral side that there is no sound because the lungs will float in fluid. Because the lung is an air-filled organ, air is lighter than fluid, and so it floats. In the case of pneumothorax, the area of no sound would be to the dorsal side because the lungs are heavier than just air, and so it tends to sag down. And this is when the animal's in sternal recumbency. Here's an x-ray of animal in lateral recumbency where if they have pneumothorax, you can see the heart lifting off of the chest wall here, the sternum. It could be due to consolidation of the lung lobe or collapse as well. When that happens, the typical way to get rid of that accumulated material, whether it's fluid or air, is to perform something called a thoracocentesis. A needle is inserted into the pleural space where the fluid is accumulated and then pulled out by a syringe. That's another angle of it. And it's a very effective way of removing the effused fluid or the air. It provides immediate relief for the patient so that they can expand their lungs again. Their tidal volume is back to more normal size. And in the case of fluids, you can take a diagnostic sample, take a look at what's in it, and be able to figure out what might be going on with the patient a little bit more that leads to adjusting of the treatment plan. If you cannot get rid of the effusion very well, or it keeps on accumulating, or if there's an infection in the chest cavity, that's when a chest tube or a thoracostomy tube is placed. And this is an example of a pyothorax in a dog, which is relatively rare, compared to pyothorax in a cat that is more common, which allows us to repeatedly aspirate out of the area so that we can continue to remove the accumulated fluid or air. In the case of pyothorax, flushing is necessary. If it's an abscess that's on the external side, you can lance it, have it drained, flush it out, and probably be okay, but we can't leave the chest cavity open because then the animal has would lose the ability to create negative pressure, which leads to difficulty breathing. And so we keep it closed, but insert a tube into it. It's nice because you can check the progress. You can take a look at the chest fluid and the quality, how much stuff is coming out of it to tell how well it's progressing as well. And here's a video of a chest tube being aspirated. This is actually about 5-6 flushings of 60 cc's of normal saline that the fluid that's coming out is now looking just somewhat cloudy. And this is what it looked like beforehand on the left bottom side of the slide. You can see with this video as well that there's all these chunks coming out that's called caseous material, cheese-like material, that is a collection of neutrophils, fibrin, bacteria that's in there that's all clumped up, that continues to come out. So you could probably see on this slide over here that that's all the chunks that came out. Okay, in the case of pneumothorax, the chest tube can have something like a one-way valve or a Heimlich valve attached to it that will allow the air to evacuate without the animal pulling air in from the outside. That provides continuous evacuation, or an actual continuous suction machine like the Thoravac or the Prolovac. There's different kinds out there, but will gently suction out the air until it reaches negative pressure, which means that all the air that can be evacuated is evacuated out. Then it starts to suck air from the outside to vent that pressure so that the machine doesn't continue sucking onto the lung tissue. We wait for natural healing. As we continue to evacuate the air out, then hopefully it'll seal up. In rare situations and severe situations, there could be surgical removal of lung tissue that has just been decimated to the point that it's irreparable. And that's a severe emergency situation. Okay, there's also something called diaphragmatic hernia. If you can take a look at this x-ray, you could probably see that there is all this white stuff, which is the abdominal content that has breached the diaphragm and occupied the chest cavity, preventing the lungs from expanding. So you can see in this orange circle area here that here are some clear lungs that have been pushed to the very much corner of the chest cavity that would not have the ability to expand as much as it should, reduces tidal volume. Most of the time, there are animals that live with this from the day that they're born as a congenital thing, and they develop just fine through it until they have some kind of traumatic incident, or they could have been normal, and they have a traumatic incident that, being hit by a car, that pushes the abdominal content through the diaphragm. The proper treatment would be to provide surgical repair. And there's been a question of timing when we should do that, whether we should stabilize the patient first and then go to surgery, or go to surgery because the surgical repair is going to be the most beneficial for the patient. And I can tell you from experience that we have had a case where we waited for stabilization, didn't realize that the abdominal content that was pushed into the chest cavity, which included the liver, was torsed. And so even that waiting of about 2 to 3 hours to try to stabilize the patient was detrimental enough that the patient succumbed to liver failure afterwards during hospitalization, post-op hospitalization. And so hemodynamically, yes, we definitely should stabilize them so that, they can deliver enough oxygen through the perfusion aspect, but there is no sense in trying to stabilize them in a respiratory sense if there is diaphragmatic hernia going on. So that would be the timing. Hemodynamic, stabilize in a hemodynamic way, which can be accomplished very quickly, and then go to surgery as soon as possible. Okay, so this pleural space disease stuff is bad because the pleural space is occupied by stuff that's not supposed to be there, air, fluid, organs. The lungs are unable to expand, which means that the animal has to take smaller breaths, decrease tidal volume, which means that our alveolar ventilation is reduced due to a reduction in tidal volume. The animal can compensate a little bit by increasing the respiratory rate, but eventually it'll get to the point where the alveolar ventilation is not sufficient such that there's hypercapnia and hypoxemia. Some other ways that the hypoventilation can occur is due to anything that causes neuromuscular disease. So tick paralysis, botulism, myasthenia gravis, coral snake venom, anything that causes dysfunction of the breathing muscles will reduce tidal volume, which could lead to hypoventilation and issues. There's something called flail chest that could occur. Take a look at this area.
Thank you.
Probably could have muted that video, so I apologize for that. You could probably tell that there was this area over here that was moving in and out as the patient was breathing, and it's due to the ribs being fractured and the rib cage not being stable. The causes are typically due to trauma. It does contribute to hypoventilation because some of that pressure that's created by negative pressure that's created by the chest is absorbed by the movement of the piece. But what's more important probably for something like a minor flail chest like this is more the contusions that could be going on. This is a patient that was attacked by a larger dog. You can see some trauma going on here, that there's contusions within the lung tissue in there as well. And that movement of the tissue can cause a lot of pain too. The treatment would be to stabilize it as best as possible, the piece that is. Some people have tried to put a bandage around the chest so that doesn't move as much. There are surgical procedures that utilizes wires to try to stabilize the pieces. In most emergency critical care situations, we don't necessarily do that, and provide good pain medication. Okay, there are some other forms of dysfunction, like pulmonary thromboembolism, where the animal could go into a hypercoagulable state where they're more likely to form clots. And there's some details that we don't really need to go into. There's different situations where an animal could enter hypercoagulable states, where the clot formed could go down a vessel that is narrowing and narrowing, and it could be macroscopic looking like this, where it lodges into the branching of the blood vessels, preventing flow of blood downstream. Or this could happen on a very microscopic level in capillaries as well, and it cuts off circulation. Pulmonary thromboembolism is bad because it creates dead space. Areas of the lungs that get ventilation without the perfusion, so which is opposite from the shunting, which was areas of perfusion without ventilation. So in these situations, the blood flow is cut off because of a clot, creating ventilation-perfusion mismatch. There's air coming in and out of this area, but there's no perfusion, so the blood-gas barrier is dysfunctional, and there's no gas exchange. There are other causes like vascular injury and hypoperfusion that could cause that, if this blood vessel is just torn off, that's vascular injury, then there's no blood gas barrier to begin with. If there is less blood flowing, it's not clogged off, but there is less blood flowing, then there's going to be less gas exchange as well. Okay, so this respiratory physiology has oxygenation, ventilation, and perfusion as a concept that needs to work perfectly in order for the patient to be breathing well enough. So what do we do when the patient is unable to perform good respiration? That's when we come to the treatment. Oxygen therapy can be performed in many different ways, like a flow-by or a mask, which is a relatively non-invasive way of providing oxygen support. But they can be very stressed due to them not being able to breathe very well, and then having a mask put on their muzzle. That's usually not the most comfortable thing for them to have, and so it could actually cause more stress sometimes, so just be careful of that. A little bit less stressful might be using something like a oxygen hood. Sometimes it's very easy to put an e-collar on and put some plastic wrap over the face of it to try to provide an area of concentrated oxygen, or probably the least stressful for them, it would be to be able to put them into an oxygen cage. Some of them are very sophisticated in that you can control the oxygen concentration and the temperature within it, and that is very helpful, especially for an animal that is very stressed. A little bit more invasive would be to utilize nasal oxygen tubes. It can be unilateral or bilateral. Oral pharyngeal tube that can be fed through the nose, and a nasal tube might end somewhere around here, but we also have the ability to push it into the oral pharynx, creating an oxygen concentrated area in the oral pharynx. And this is an animal with it, although you can't tell from the external side. Nasal prongs can work with some of the animals. Some of them don't like that tickling going on in the tip of the nose, and so it depends on the patient. Probably the most invasive way of providing oxygen would be to use something called a transtracheal catheter that you can percutaneously poke through the neck into the trachea to provide oxygen directly which is not very commonly performed. Now, that's oxygenation. What if the animal has hypercapnia? What do we do with that? Well, treatment of hypercapnia is not as easy. That you can't just make an animal breathe harder or larger breaths or faster breaths. And so you have to focus on treating the underlying cause. There are, if that's not enough though, if standard therapy isn't enough, there are forms of negative pressure ventilation that you can provide. This is something called the iron lung that was more prominent in the United States, at least in the 1960s, where the polio epidemic was going on. And this is a pretty common scene from an ICU floor during that time. And these mechanisms create negative pressure around the person's body so that it augments the ability for the patient to breathe. There are things called negative pressure carosis also that is used for various kinds of respiratory dysfunction. But most of us provide IPPV instead. And you might be thinking, what the heck is IPPV? That's intermittent positive pressure ventilation. And it can be manual or mechanical. So if you do something like this, close the pop-off valve, give the animal a breath, you're providing intermittent positive pressure ventilation. It can be done with a ventilator, a surgical ventilator, or a critical care ventilator is something that's more ideal for long-term, where it creates positive pressure on the outside, normal pressure on the inside, creating that pressure gradient, making the air rush in. It does require an airway, but it is an effective method of reducing worker breath, creating recruitment of the lungs, and controlling the breathing. And that's where we get to critical care ventilation. When there is severe pulmonary disease, that long-term therapy is required. And some of the less intensive treatments, such as medical interventions and oxygen supplementation, isn't enough. And I would say it's not enough when there's persistent hypoxemia or hypoventilation, even through the therapy, or if the animal is about to go into fatigue. That's when we utilize critical care ventilation. So hang in there, 30 seconds to go over critical care ventilation. Ready for that? All right. Well, if a patient is placed on a critical care ventilator, there's a lot of things that we need to do in order to monitor the patient. Monitor the vital parameters, cardiovascular system, oxygenation. So the things that we would be running would be things like the ECG, end-tidal CO2, SpO2, analyzing blood gases, and measuring perfusion parameters. It's not only necessary to monitor the patients, but to monitor the ventilator as well through the ventilator settings, what responses we're getting, because just because we punch in numbers into the ventilator doesn't necessarily mean that we get what we want. It also may not agree with the patient and how they want to breathe. That leads to the bucking of the ventilators or dyssynchrony. The patient needs to be careful in terms of the airway. We need to be careful of keeping aseptic and sterile technique with the airway so that we don't introduce any sort of bacteria that causes ventilator-associated pneumonia. That's a common issue. And there's all sorts of catheters that these animals would have that needs to be cared for. The body itself needs to be cared for because the patient can't take care of themselves. They're on heavy sedation or general anesthesia, so we need to take care of their eyes, their mouth, clear their mouth out, the body itself, urinary and fecal needs, musculoskeletal care through passive range of motions, trying to prevent atrophy as much as possible. And so it's a huge ordeal that's very intensive. And so these ventilator cases are relentlessly intensive. It requires constant care and attention. And you can see from these photos that as we progress through these slides, it's gotten better and better in terms of our setup. That's kind of the evolution of mechanical ventilation at our practice. And it's a huge team effort. There's usually one person on the patient, one person taking care of the ventilator, and another person that's doing ancillary matters, fetching things, putting things into the record, helping with the nursing care. It almost turns into a three-person job. But with that said, it's very, it's both challenging and rewarding, because we could have a patient like McNeil here, came in with a because the owners experienced him gulping a lot, there was some kind of swelling going on in his throat. And as we were trying to place an IV catheter, he panicked and collapsed again, and we had to endotracheally intubate him. At first, didn't need mechanical ventilation. But as the situation progressed, we found some chitinous material that we thought might have been from a bug or something that entered his throat, maybe bit him, created a neurologic disease situation where the patient stopped breathing. So we had to put him on mechanical ventilation. After a couple of days of mechanical ventilation, he regained the ability to breathe on his own. We were able to get him off the ventilator. He couldn't stand in this photo. He came off the ventilator, but he couldn't stand, and that's where we see him in this photo. But eventually, he regained his ability to use his muscles, and he's now 4 or 5 years old, and he's a big goof. So mechanical ventilation is one of those things that can be very valuable in sustaining life through temporary situations that they can get over. Okay, I know that was a little bit long, but that's all I have to say about respiratory emergencies and how we take care of him, and thank you very much for listening.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Kenichiro for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.